Well, let me thank once again the organizers of this wonderful event, Rana, Nana, Katrin, and Hannah, and the various other people involved in getting all of us here to this wonderfully conceptualized event. Let me thank all of you also for your great commitment. It is now, I think, 20 to 11, and here you are still in this auditorium. So thank you for remaining on. I'm afraid that what I'm going to try and do in dealing with this theme of continuity is to engage in some fairly close textual analysis of certain key documents. I don't know whether this is the right time or whether all of you are in the right frame of mind to actually engage in this exercise, but let me attempt to do so nevertheless. And let me also attempt to comment on the very rich presentations that we have heard from our three colleagues. The story of civilization could be told from a number of different vantage points and from a number of different beginnings. And so when confronted with this difficulty of where to begin, I thought I would begin with this event. And it is an event, I think, which most of you would recognize. It is the arrival of Columbus in the New World. This is a 19th century portrait. And it's an interesting portrait because it's almost Columbus as seen from the point of view of the natives. Because here is this party arriving, and there's the question of who is seeing this arrival. But of course, there's a contradiction involved here because what is presented is an idealized Western view of itself being presented in some respect as the native perspective on this arrival of Columbus. But apart from the visual, you could say, representation of this arrival, and we can see the cross, we can see the standard being unfurled, let me go to the actual language and the text by which Columbus himself described his arrival in the New World. I'm not particularly competent in dealing with these contraptions, so I hope this works. Okay. So this is a translation of the Spanish, because Columbus reported to his sovereigns in the Spanish language. And to try and make it a little easier, let me attempt to mimic, I suppose, a Spanish accent. This is Columbus. Sir, as I know, you will be pleased at the great victory with which our Lord has crowned my voyage. I write this to you, from which you will learn how in 33 days I passed from the Canary Islands to the Indies with the fleet which the most illustrious king and queen, our sovereigns, gave to me. And there I have found many islands filled with people innumerable. And of them all I have taken possession for their highnesses, by proclamation made and with royal standard unfurled, and no opposition was offered to me. To the first island which I found, I gave the name San Salvador in remembrance of the divine majesty, sorry about the typo there, who has marvelously bestowed all this. The Indians call it Guanahani. To the second, I gave the name Isla de Santa Maria de Concepcion. To the third, Fernandino. To the fourth, Isabella. To the fifth, Isla Juana. And so to each, I gave a new name. So it is interesting to reflect on this moment and how Columbus tries to deal with this issue. It is very interesting, for example, that he doesn't know where he is. He thinks he is in the East Indies. He doesn't know who these people are. He just describes them as innumerable. And what is his first action? His first action is an action of possession. This moment is as profoundly radical as the moment which some of you might have seen the film Arrival, which has just come to the cinemas. It is almost as though an alien species is encountering humans for the first time. It is as radically a moment of such radical difference. And so we can see that the first act Columbus engages in is something like a legal act. He takes possession. It's a very odd thing, isn't it? to be encountered by strangers, and the first thing those strangers would do is to say, "I am taking possession of you." That instinct itself is quite telling. But apart from the instinct, the interesting question is, what are the legal mechanisms by which he tries to complete this legal act of possession? And can we see the problem? The problem is, what is the legal universe that is commonly shared by both the parties to this encounter? Can we see that issue? Because for us to be bound by a law, we must participate in its making. We must acknowledge that it is the law that applies to us. That's the problem Columbus faces. And do we see the clever way in which he tries to resolve that? By proclamation made and with royal standard unfurled. So these are the rituals. And in fact, if we have a look at the portrait, we can see him doing exactly that, the royal standard unfurled. And so the best he can come up with here is to say, "And no opposition was offered to me." So it is an argument based on something like a very crude form of consent. I ask these people, "Do you mind if I take you over and serve from now on as your conqueror and sovereign?" And they said nothing, so therefore they have accepted this particular bargain. So can we see this very interesting way in which the Indians, misnamed, are given the opportunity to speak and yet are simultaneously silenced? They are given the opportunity to speak, they say nothing, and in saying nothing, they are speaking. But they are saying what Columbus wants them to say. Can we see that issue? So it's a little like the portrait in that regard. It's presented as the perception of the natives, but it is, in fact, the way in which Columbus would like to see himself being perceived by the natives. Can we see that structure of representation and disempowerment, which we find not only textually, but also in this portrait? And then can we see the whole question of renaming, where language itself becomes a mechanism of really eradication? And can we see the interesting point at which the ability of the Indians to speak is actually acknowledged? He says, "The Indians call it Guanahani." So he acknowledges their ability to speak precisely when he's erasing that identity, the identity of Guanahani, by renaming it, as the case may be, Isla de Santa Maria de Concepcion, Fernandino, and so forth. So what I'm trying to suggest is the way in which we find from the very beginnings of the colonial encounter, this process of seeming to accommodate outsiders within the system and then at the same time suppress them. So he gives them the opportunity to speak and then speaks for them. So this is Columbus. This is the best he can do. And of course, there was a highly developed ritual that all the European powers engaged in as far as this process of planting flags and the royal standard and so forth are concerned. Columbus is concerned not just about taking sovereignty from the Indians, he's also concerned about the possibility that the Portuguese or some other European empire might also arrive and make claims to the same territory, although there was a treaty that the Pope had already drawn up, which tried to divide up the world. Now, this approach to trying to deal with the question of how the Spanish acquired sovereignty over the New World was a question that Columbus tried to solve in the way he did. But the lawyers of the time were not satisfied by this. And one of the principal lawyers of the time, and in fact, in this stage of history, the lawyers were also basically theologians, they were priests. So here we have somebody who's regarded as one of the founding fathers of international law. His name is Francisco de Vitoria, and he gave a series of lectures called On the Indians Lately Discovered. And there he says, Although the Aborigines in question are not wholly unintelligent, yet they are a little short of that condition, and so are unfit to found or administer a lawful state up to the standard required by human and civil claims. Accordingly, they have no proper laws, no magistrates, and are not even capable of controlling their family affairs. Now, again, we can see this move of saying, actually, they are not wholly unintelligent, because these lawyers claimed that everybody is in fact, governed by a universal law, and that is the universal law of nature, a natural law. And how are we to find out what that law is? Well, we have to be endowed with reason. So can you see the importance of him saying they are not wholly unintelligent? Because in saying that they are not wholly unintelligent, what he's suggesting is they are capable of reason, and because they are capable of reason, it is acceptable to hold them to be bound by this universal natural law. So can we see then that they belong to this universal order, and yet, at the same time, they are inferior. They are unfit to found or administer a lawful state. So already we get some idea of the state and political organization as being one of the principal issues that would be examined in deciding whether a people are civilized or not civilized. Political organization is crucial to the division between the civilized and the uncivilized. And even though in the English language the word civilization enters the language really in about the 16th or 17th century, we can see already the term civil claims. So civil being connected with the idea of citizenship and the idea of living in a society. So political organization is crucial to the issue of civilization. So this is Vittoria, writing in 1530, and writing in a state of great concern and distress, it should be said, because many of the writers of that time, some of you might have heard of Las Casas, were deeply concerned about what they saw as the massive violence taking place in the New World. And we have a picture of that here, the endless massacres that were inflicted on the native peoples. Native peoples were fed to the dogs. There was ongoing massacres taking place. Now, on one hand, the Spanish priests, at least some of the Spanish priests, such as Vittoria, were very concerned about this. But at the same time, what they were trying to say was, these people are like us, but inferior. And because they are like us, we have a role to play in making them more like us. So we see something Brigitta's presentation also dealt with, which is the idea of you can catch up. That there will be a time when you too can be like us. And a similar theme is found in David's presentation, when David points out that what is radical about the General Assembly resolution of 1960 is the fact that the third world says, we are not going to delay any longer. You cannot use our backwardness as an excuse any longer. You have to give us our freedom now. So that's a radical moment, as David suggests, because there's no longer an acceptance of this idea of, all right, in time we will catch up. We will be completely civilized in the way that the West is civilized. This is Vittoria in 1530. I'm skipping a few centuries because I've got 30 minutes. So this is the Argentine jurist Carlos Calvo, a very famous jurist. And by the time the 19th century arrived, a different jurisprudence had emerged. That was the jurisprudence of positivism. And that was something that Nana mentioned in her presentation as well. So one of the basic tenets of the 19th century international law was that civilized people are sovereign, but uncivilized people are not sovereign or are only quasi-sovereign. And so it became a very complex arrangement where Europe was always sovereign. Turkey continued to be an issue, even though Turkey had been officially accepted in 1856. It was always seen as something of an outsider. So Turkey was continuously striving, as perhaps it still is, to be accepted as part of the civilized nations of the world. And so then the question became, well, what is the standard of civilization? What is the test we have to pass? And Carlos Calvo says, the state of man in society as opposed to barbarity, civilization is the result of the reciprocal action of industry, the arts, the sciences, literature, morals, religion, in one word, of all that can have an influence over the spirit of man, contribute to the development of his potential and of the satisfaction of his needs and his well-being in general. International law is one of the most precious fruits of civilization because it has become one of the bases of the organization of societies and therefore an essential element in the harmonic march of humanity. So we have all the elements outlined. By now, civilization deals with literature, the arts, all these issues. And remember family affairs. You know, Vittoria said they do not have proper control even over their families. So isn't it interesting how the manner in which different societies deal with family issues could also be regarded as a mark of their civilization? But here he says international law itself is one of the most precious fruits of civilization. So now international law, having excluded the vast majority of people in the world, then presents itself as the redeemer. Can we see this dual, mechanism by which all these people are excluded and disempowered, and then international law presents itself as the redeemer, as the force that will bring all these uncivilized people into the realm of civilization and into the realm of sovereignty. So this was the center of civilization in the 19th century when these issues were really crucial. And then there were complicated issues, such as the issue of China. Is China civilized or not? Now, it's hard to deny that even by European standards, China was fairly civilized. In fact, it had an empire, and it was one of the most, it was the most advanced society in the world in the 17th century. So then the European approach was, well, they're civilized, but they are differently civilized. They are not civilized in the way that we are civilized, and they have to adapt. And we can get a sense of what that involved from John Westlake. John Westlake was the professor of international law at Cambridge. He held the UL chair, which is still a chair that is a very prestigious chair of Cambridge University, held by a very distinguished colleague. And John Westlake in 1894 says, when the people of European race come into contact with American African tribes, the prime necessity is a government under the protection of which the former may carry on the complex life to which they have become accustomed in their homes, which may prevent that life from being disturbed by contests between different European powers for supremacy on the same soil, and which may protect the natives in the enjoyment of a security and well-being, at least not less than they had enjoyed before the arrival of the strangers. Can the natives furnish such a government, or can it be looked for from Europeans alone? In the answer to that question lies, for international law, the difference between civilization and the want of it. So we see once again the idea of government being crucial to civilization. And the test of government here, and he's considering Asian societies and African societies, the test of whether a proper government is in existence is the question of, will a European be able to enjoy the same freedoms in this foreign society as he would in his home society in civilized Europe? Can we see that issue? It's very interesting from the point of view of migration, which is the panel we're going to have tomorrow, because in migration, the standard concept of the issue of migration is there is a sovereign state, and the sovereign state has the absolute right to admit or not admit a foreign individual. In this case, what we see is that it is the foreign individual who is fundamental to the very definition of sovereignty. Can we see that contrast? Because it is only if the foreign government creates a society in which the European individual enjoys the same freedoms as that individual would enjoy back in Europe that the foreign government could be said to be civilized. Can we see the complete contrast? And fascinatingly, this is the test that many countries tried to pass. So the most prominent example of this would be Japan. Japan transformed itself in a very radical manner to try and mimic and reproduce, you could say, the systems of government that are found in the West. So some of you might have seen Tom Cruise, The Last Samurai. So the whole idea is we have to have a military which would be the same as a Western military. We have to have a bureaucracy. We have to have a legal system that would have the same structures and institutions that Europe enjoys. And in fact, Japan was astonishingly successful in this endless task of trying to meet the standard of civilization. So finally, Japan was admitted to the family of nations in important respects. But how did that occur? It occurred in 1905 when the Japanese Navy defeated the Russian Navy in the Battle of Tsushima in 1905. And the Japanese admiral said something like, "We demonstrate that we can make war as effectively as you, and as soon as we do that, we are admitted into the realm of the family of civilized nations." So you can see the sarcasm of the Japanese admiral, because he saw through the, you could say, the whole issue, and he said, it's all a question of power and violence and our ability to inflict violence. That is the real test of whether we are civilized or not. Now, the other aspect about Japan was Japan felt that in order to be truly civilized, it had to itself become a colonial power. Because it is when you are a colonial power that you are on the side of civilization playing the role of civilizing the barbarians. And so we can see Japan during this period gradually expanding its influence and engaging with wars in China, with Korea. I don't have time to read to you the treaty between Japan and Korea, but it is wonderful in the way in which Japan reproduces the language of civilization in its treatment of its neighbor, Korea. So can we see then that violence and imperialism are crucial to becoming civilized? To put it somewhat shortly. And then we come to 1885, and how could I resist the Berlin Conference, given where we are? And so we see the same language, wishing in the spirit of good and mutual accord to regulate the conditions most favorable to the development of trade and civilization in certain regions of Africa, and to assure to all nations the advantages of free navigation on the two chief rivers of Africa flowing into the Atlantic Ocean. So we see the language of civilization being presented here. And just to point to a theme that we will deal with in more detail tomorrow, if all of you have the energy, and hopefully we have the energy, and that is the issue of governance and trade. Because civilization and trade are very closely connected, as we see from the language of the Berlin Conference, the final act of Berlin. And we see, I won't go through all this, it's late, we don't have very much time, but the idea of bringing natives the blessings of civilization. Let's see whether this works. Oh yeah, the blessings of civilization. So that is what was going to be provided by the European colonization and occupation of Africa, civilization. And also they would say, a manifestation of our campaign to bring about civilization is the abolition of the slave trade. So that was a very powerful campaign to justify and in some way demonstrate that, in fact, Europe was engaged in a civilizing mission. It was saving the natives from all these atrocities. It was helping redeem the natives. Of course, some of you would know what the aftermath of the Berlin Conference was. Well, Africa was divided up, not immediately in the Berlin Conference, but subsequently. And if we had a map of Africa, we could say you could see the straight borders, which created all sorts of issues when it came to the issue of the nation state. And then, this is the Berlin Conference. Clearly, the artist recognized and wanted the viewers to recognize the very distinguished European statesmen who were involved in this conference. I was trying to get a list of the names, so I asked a colleague at Humboldt, and he said, here's the book, will you come and collect it? I didn't have time to go and collect it, so I can't give you all the names. But I think we can see Bismarck there, isn't it? And we can see, it was interesting, Turkey was present at this conference. But the people who are absent, of course, was, well, we don't see a dark face, really, among those present. And so Africa is there. You can see the map in the background. And that was the map that was used as the basis of dividing up Africa and creating free trade arrangements around it. So Africa is present only as a map. We might think of Lawrence and his presentation of the significance of maps in these circumstances. It would be almost ironic, but this wasn't ironic in terms of how the artist represents this event. And I think you can see all the names at the, on the bottom, if only I could read that closely. What resulted in Africa was, you could say, various atrocities, the whole disaster of the Congo, which is going to be discussed tomorrow in detail by one of our colleagues, Jean Bafane. Any of you want to guess how many people are estimated to have died under this humanitarian regime of King Leopold? Between 5 and 10 million. Between 5 and 10 million. There have been no reparations. There's hardly been an acknowledgement in itself. And it's very interesting, perhaps another whole, you could say, another whole exhibition could be done about Belgian monuments and the continued celebration, in many respects, of King Leopold and his reign. One of the punishments meted out to Africans who failed to collect the rubber that was essential at this time, industrialization was taking place at this time, it needed rubber, it needed ivory. And natives who failed to meet the quotas allocated to them had their hands cut off. There are many pictures that can be shown of natives showing only their stump. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that in the current wars that have taken place in Africa, one of the weapons used by the combatants is precisely to cut off the hands, the limbs, of the civilians, of the ordinary people. Now, I don't know whether that originated with the Belgian control of the Congo, but certainly it took place at that time. Okay. The idea of civilization also finds itself into the statute of the International Court of Justice. So the International Court of Justice, the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, has included in its statute the language that it would administer general principle of law recognized by civilized nations. In other words, it would look to the legal systems of civilized nations, Europe principally, perhaps America, if it could be included there, and that would be allowed. That is the law that would be administered. So can we see once again how the idea of civilization is reproduced in a supposedly post-colonial, decolonized era? This is language that we find in the statute of the International Court of Justice. It has to be said that it's regarded as something of an embarrassment now. But I still think it's important to show the origins of this, how this division is reproduced. All right, I have to fast forward a great deal. I'm not sure what else is there. Okay, I really have to fast forward, and I have to come to the present. Does the standard of civilization still exist in any form in our international system, in the world of international relations? I'm really accelerating all this, but again, Berlin is crucial because the fall of the Berlin Wall suggested that there is now one appropriate system of political organization, which is democracy, and one form of economic arrangements, which is the market. And so at this time, international law was seen as triumphant, and the argument was, And we can see this an argument made by Boutros Ghali. His argument was, democratization is now a universal value. That is the new standard of civilization. And this has been proved by history, as it were. Some of you would know of the influential book of Francis Fukuyama, The End of History. And so then the question was, how do we bring democracy to all these countries which are backward? So we can see that it's no longer civilized and uncivilized. That language is no longer regarded as acceptable, but it is democratic and non-democratic. And international organizations are very powerfully oriented towards a particular vision of democracy. Now, I'm not making an argument against democracy, but what I would claim, and I don't have time to develop the argument, is that it is a vision of democracy which is what I would call low-intensity democracy, which is compatible with massive economic inequality. That is a form of democracy that is being promoted by many of these international institutions, especially relating to the World Bank and the IMF. That's something I have to deal with on another occasion. The other problem with this issue of democracy was the argument that if democracy is a universal standard, then surely it must be permitted to use violence to bring about democracy. And so can we see this is another aspect of the whole division between the civilized and uncivilized? The argument is, in an effort to bring about civilization, we are authorized to take action that would otherwise be regarded as illegal or unpermitted. So there have been cases of so-called democratic intervention that have occurred, even though this is not something that a strict reading of international law would permit. And this is what one of the Zanana Gosmao is the great leader of East Timor, which became independent in about 1999 after its occupation by Indonesia. And at first, the East Timorese welcomed the United Nations because it saw the United Nations as being a savior of the people of East Timor. And then, can we see the new bearers of the standard of civilization? Hundreds of international experts. So civilization is now something, or the idea of civilization, or the idea of liberal democracy is something that international institutions and international experts are promoting in various ways. And so I can make this argument more clearly if I had more time and if I were to talk about the World Bank and the IMF, which is something I will do tomorrow. But my claim basically is that we can see that a version of the standard of civilization continues to operate through a new language. It is a new set of dichotomies between the developed and the developing, the liberal and the non-liberal. So some scholars have suggested that there should be a special regime of international law that operates only among liberal states, because liberal states obey the law and non-liberal states do not. And that was an argument made very seriously by very prominent scholars. We can see the complications with this argument, and I don't know whether I had a 3-minute video of President Bush talking about the axis of evil. I don't know whether that can be shown or whether I've run out of time.
From threatening America, okay, or our friends and allies.
Please listen to the term civilization.
Mass destruction. Some of these regimes have been pretty quiet since September the 11th. But we know their true nature. North Korea is a regime arming with missiles and weapons of mass destruction while starving its citizens. Iran aggressively pursues these weapons and exports terror, while an unelected few repress the Iranian people's hope for freedom. Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax and nerve gas and nuclear weapons for over a decade. This is a regime that has already used poison gas to murder thousands of its own citizens, leaving the bodies of mothers huddled over their dead children. This is a regime that agreed to international inspections, then kicked out the inspectors, This is a regime that has something to hide from the civilized world. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world by seeking weapons of mass destruction.
Okay.
These regimes pose...
We will go to the next slide there. So we can see the interesting use of the word civilized yet again. And one of the interesting things is how the word civilized in that context obscures a very complex history of relationships between the countries he mentions and the campaign he's going to engage in. So certainly I am not a champion of North Korea and or of Iran. But it's interesting how the argument seems to be if they are rogue states, if they are uncivilized states, then they cannot have weapons. In a situation where the United States itself has enough weapons to destroy the world several times over, the United States is not really, I would say, meeting its obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which regulates this whole issue. But the other interesting point is that what President Bush proceeded to do by invoking the uncivilized is the uncivilized represent a threat. And so in order to then eradicate that threat, what is necessary is violence and transformation. So we can understand the mention of democracy. The argument would be, we need to democratize, at least the argument was made at the time, we need to democratize Iraq, because if we democratize Iraq, it will be a peaceful, safe society that we can coexist with. But of course, what happens as a result of all this is not so much the democratization of Iraq. I think we are still some way from that. I think there was a final image I wanted to capture, and this is Abu Ghraib. So if we have a look at, it's a very potted version of history, if we look at Vittoria in the 16th century, his invocation of civilization leads to, or is in some way implicated with, even though it tries to distance itself from, the violence that takes place in the 17th century directed against the Native Americans. In Berlin, we have the invocation of civilization, which leads in a complicated way to the deaths of millions of Africans, whose deaths are, I don't know how to think about this, but we, you know, we still can't come to terms with it, and it's still obscured by history in many respects. And then, of course, the invocation of civilization here is also important, because what President Bush then does is use this as a justification to, in effect, violate the law of the United Nations, because the law of the United Nations has a regime to deal with these types of situations. But President Bush says, they are uncivilized, and because they are uncivilized, the normal law does not apply. We need to take these extraordinary measures, the emergency measures that are essential for the protection of our security. And so we can see that international law itself becomes, in this respect, distorted and, in fact, violated by an invocation of the uncivilized. The uncivilized are a threat. Whatever it takes is authorized to deal with this situation. And Vittoria, going back to 1530, Vittoria says something like, whatever is necessary to defend the realm, whatever is necessary to defend the realm is justified. So we now come to arguments that are very much part of the world in which we live, arguments of necessity, arguments of emergency, arguments of these are extraordinary circumstances in which the normal law does not apply. And of course, one of the great scholars presenting this argument is someone I'm sure all of you are very familiar with. His name is Carl Schmitt. He is, in many respects, the most brilliant, writer on this topic, and he haunts us still. But it's very interesting how all these attempts to bring about civilization result in atrocities. And we then ask, well, is there some essential? Is there some connection between these two things, or is it only incidental? So some would say Abu Ghraib, that was an aberration. That is not what bringing justice is about. That is an aberration. Another interpretation would be no. In fact, all attempts to bring about justice and humanitarianism in this particular vein inevitably results in these barbarities. So we commit barbarities in the name of civilization. And this is a structure that perhaps still continues to haunt the world in which we live of international law and international relations. Thank you very much.